What we know about AI already is that it bluffs better than we do. It outcompetes us every time we compete against it. We do not win against that kind of AI. And that's the kind of AI we're building. And that's the kind of AI I'm trying to get in front of with Amaranthine. So, for me, Amaranthine is really a call to action to say, do we want to live in paradise or don't we? Because the reality is there is nothing between us and paradise but ourselves.
Thursday, August 3rd, 2023. This is exactly 19 years since I launched Living on Purpose on CHLY in Nanaimo, British Columbia, on Vancouver Island. And today we have an intriguing topic all about AI, artificial intelligence, how to create a regenerative civilization using artificial intelligence. And I kind of have a feeling that we're being tracked just even using that term, because AI never sleeps, right? It's hard for us to imagine even that sliding into our civilization. Hangame. And Richard, welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
Hangame is a friend of mine from British Columbia who's now in Ottawa, and Richard is the one who introduced me to our featured speaker today, Michael Thorne Kelly, PhD, who goes by Mike. And Mike contends that it's possible that we're in a new time, in a better time. Oh, you have a copy of his book right there? Look at that. And how do you say it?
Amaranthine.
Amaranthine.
That's how I say it. What do you think of the cover design?
I'm curious why he made such a colorful, bouncy cover.
Because he wanted to practice using
Oh, of course.
AI.
Well,
Yes.
that's it. I was just doing a little solo preamble before you two showed up. He should be showing up anytime now, too. And yeah, commenting on how it's just sliding into so many parts of our lives. I mean, no distinction, right?
It's got to the point where I think something and I get an email about it in 2 minutes' time.
And you haven't typed anything? That's concerning.
It's the way I communicate with my wife.
Is she as responsive to your thoughts?
She's usually said it before I've thought it, actually.
Oh, so yeah, which comes first, right?
I know, I know. There's Michael.
And here's Michael Kelly.
I.
Mike.
Michael, you're wearing a clean shirt.
Well, Richard, you and I know each other so well. Wonderful to see you.
So we can call you Mike, right?
Oh, please. Yeah. It's a funny thing. For the first 50 or so years of my life, I was Michael. And then one day, boom, I was Mike. Michael didn't feel like me at all. It was just Mike. How weird is that? Just some clue about how really weird I am.
Well, I guess I could ask how many years has it been then, because I don't know your age.
I'm 74.
What?
Yeah. All the damage is internal, trust me.
Oh, I thought you were somewhere in your late 50s or something. Yeah, you look great.
Well, thank you.
Must be doing something right. How long? For an hour, right, Mike?
So, an hour, sure.
I think an hour is good. That's what we're expecting. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
Are you an associate of Hangame's? Yes.
Yes, I am.
Nice.
Hi, Mike.
Well, that's great. Well, we have our featured author here, Mike, and Richard, who introduced us, and I'm Lynn. And are you in Ottawa, Mark?
Yes, I am.
Great. Okay. Yeah, I'm in Newmarket, just north of Toronto. Where are you, Mike?
I'm in Maine,
Right.
in Bath, right on the coast.
And Richard.
I am in Cold Spring, Kentucky, which is across the Ohio River from Cincinnati.
But his heart's in Cornwall.
England or Canada?
Oh, not England, Britain. Cornwall,
Well, take that, Mark.
don't ever say to a Cornishman or woman that they're in England. Cornwall is part of the Celtic French. When the Anglo-Saxons invaded in the 430s, 450s, They pushed the Scots, the Irish, the Welsh and the Cornish and the Manxmen to the fringe, and people in Brittany as well. The language survives. The rebelliousness survives.
I see that.
In Cornish, that would be bloody-mindedness. But there's a flourishing Cornish-American society in Toronto.
And we are welcoming Rose.
Hello, Lynn. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Thanks for joining us. That's awesome.
Yay.
Where are you located?
Well, I'm in Vancouver, and I also am in Chilliwack.
Oh, okay.
BC, yeah.
Oh, hello, Nancy.
Hi, Lynn.
And you're in Flagstaff, is that right?
Correct.
Right. Yeah, so I'd like to welcome formally Michael Thorne Kelly, PhD, known as Mike. You are the author of Amerinthine, and the subtitle is How to Create a Regenerative Civilization Using Artificial Intelligence. And Richard introduced us, which is awesome. And you've certainly kept my brain nimble over this last week or so preparing for today. And I would say that AI is probably already tracking us because it doesn't sleep or eat or have to evacuate or get pensions or anything, right? So there's nothing holding it back, no doubt, no self-worth issues. I mean, it's just a moving machine, right? So I just am astounded at how AI, artificial intelligence, is just seeping into our civilization. And you see this as an important time and a different time as to how we can make use of it. And you have written a book about a lot of stuff, oh my goodness, in this regard. And I'd love to have a bit of background from you as to why you're an expert in this. Have you actually built an AI system, and why psychology has been a longtime passion of yours? There's a place to start.
Sure. I don't consider myself an expert in much of anything anymore. Two or three years ago, I realized why I've spent my life writing this book, and I literally have spent my life writing this book. When I was 12, my dad, who was a fighter pilot, had been called up for the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he called me into the bedroom as he was packing, and he said, "Son, my jet will carry a Mark 28 nuclear weapon. I've been called up. Take care of your mother and sisters." So that was my coming of age in the United States. And I remember an overwhelming sense of panic at the thought of that I was supposed to take care of my mother and sisters. And fortunately, obviously, everything was resolved. And as far as memory goes, I moved on, right? But apparently some part of me didn't move on. Perhaps it was the shock of that. But suddenly, I became fascinated, and obsessed wouldn't be too strong a term, with why human beings do what they do. So by the time I went off to college, I was already reading psych textbooks and also recognizing that I didn't understand why some things I could learn instantly, boom, read it once, got it. And other things I could read over and over and over again, just they would not stick. Literally, just I could not learn. So I ended up doing a PhD in both experimental and clinical psychology. And I practiced as a clinician for about a decade in Manhattan. You'd actually recognize the names of some of the kids I worked with then. One of my clients, for instance, had lived in on the floor of a building, the whole floor of a building overlooking Central Park. But in the process of that, I realized that I did not want to be a psychotherapist. And I became fascinated with how organizations structure themselves, manage getting things done. And I ended up becoming a management consultant. And that career took me into the upper levels of the Secretaries of Defense and Energy and the executive offices of Fortune 50 and 100 companies. And I got pretty deep in the world. And then about 15 years ago, I finally realized I could say something. It's not that I hadn't tried. You know, I think the first time I tried to write some of my ideas down was in the early 80s. And I just couldn't get it all together. It was just a huge mishmash of psychology, anthropology, archaeology, behavioral economics, systems theory. It was overwhelming, the amount of stuff I was being forced to absorb in my attempt to make any sense out of why human beings kept making the same crazy mistakes over and over and over again. And so in 2011, I sat down one day and I wrote an outline. And it was the first time I was able to write an outline from beginning to end. And I just filled in the outline. And by 2016, I had a book. And it explained why human beings do what they do and what we would have to do to keep from destroying ourselves. Because all civilizations rise and fall. And when they fall, they tend to take everything with them. Pretty much 10,000 years of history demonstrating that at this point. And then I ended up being very depressed for about 2 years because I realized that human beings simply were not biologically wired to do what had to be done to get off the roller coaster of history, to get off of this sequence of emergence. You know, the we phase of civilization, we hang together or we hang separately. You know, there's a beginning phase of a civilization when it's all about we. And then somewhere when the civilization becomes very successful, it tips over into me and it becomes all about me. And from there on out, you're headed downhill and eventually into basically a state of such rigidity that even trivial catastrophes, the typical things that upend civilizations, climate change, invaders, whatever, instead of pulling a society together to meet it, everybody just throws up their hands and basically attacks each other rather than dealing with the problems. So when I realized that we, by nature, couldn't do what had to be done, it was a pretty black period. And then I was reading a science fiction book, and a lot of my consulting had been in the tech area, so I was very familiar with artificial intelligence. And Ian Banks imagined this wonderful artificial intelligence that was wise and ridiculously witty. And I thought, wow, I wonder, could you actually create an artificial intelligence like that? And I did. I mean, I went through all the things that I knew about artificial intelligence, the breakthroughs that were being made, and I made a procedural, and it has to be procedural because you've got to turn it into code, a procedural description of a type of AI that would help us avoid the natural reflex that caused us to shift from we to me. Because it's an automatic reflex. It's not conscious. It's just something human beings are always going to go through at some point in a society. That shift from, it's us to it's me. We all hover in that space generally anyway, but the surrounding society, the context, will push us in one way or the other way. And there's a lot of research on how wealth distorts the way people think. And I won't get into that because I'm taking an awfully long time answering this very simple question. So I think you get the idea.
Some good background. Yeah, through your experience and through your observation, you've noticed the difference between competition and collaboration, right? And the difference it can make. And then there's also the whole thing of how AI is rolling out now that you think has some limitations and some implications for danger for our civilization. And so what you have imagined and created and proposed structure for, how is it different and how will it save us? And how are you implementing it? How would we know it?
Sure. Lynn, is it possible to share my screen with you?
Yes, it's going to be audio, so use your words with it as well. That would be great.
I will use my words with it. Okay, so what you see is a circular diagram with six hexagons around a central hexagon. And right now, the way AI is being developed, the central hexagon says zero sum. So this is competition. This is economic rationalism. It's the thinking. It's sort of like the civilizational algorithm that we're caught up in right now. You're either a winner or you're a loser. I can talk about that for several hours. So you probably all already know that. And then around it are all of the elements that are necessary for an AI to be a sapient intelligence, not just a sentient intelligence. I mean, on some level, insects are sentient. You know, they have a sense of self-awareness, but that's not sufficient. We need a sapient intelligence, as are we. You know, that ability to conceptualize, to understand that I have a mind, you have a mind, and I can imagine what it's like to be you and this sort of thing. So you've got raw perception, you've got filtered perception, and that's where you're seeing things the way other beings would see them. And then there's the issue of identity, and there's motivation and regulation and agency. So you have to have all of those boxes filled to have a sapient artificial intelligence. And right now, the problem with the way AI is being developed is that it's in that zero-sum context. So take your ChatGPT-4, the things that are so exciting to people lately, partly because they're useful, right? Well, the way we create those is we train them by showing them how we make decisions. So you could argue in those six boxes around the central zero sum one, all of this ChatGPT stuff literally fits into one box, that filtered perception box. They don't have independent perception. They don't have identity. They don't have motivation. They don't have regulation. They don't have agency. They only have filtered perception. And what is that perception filtered through? Us. We train them on ourselves. We send them out on the internet and say, how would you answer X question? And so basically they're a mirror for us. And right now we're operating in a zero-sum world. You know, that's the me part of civilization. The we part of civilization is not a zero-sum game. It's much more cooperative, much more collaborative. Zero-sum is all about competition. Somebody's got to win, somebody's got to lose. It's like musical chairs. So civilization at some point begins playing musical chairs. So my AI, actually, let me see if this, oh, yes, it will. All right. So for those of you who can see my screen, you can see that a little more clearly. Well, my AI is fundamentally different. It looks like this. So its context isn't zero sum. It's fitness. And you can think of this. There was a famous Italian Renaissance architect who described beauty as a combination of elements, some of which might not naturally go together, such that to remove any one of them destroyed the whole. And that was his definition of beauty. And then the Navajo built their whole civilization around the concept of the beauty way, in which they saw the universe, nature, everything as a harmony. And the cultural expectation was that people would strive to walk in beauty, walk in harmony. And so what I did was I, starting from that frame of reference, I asked, well, what does it need to be able to perceive? What filters does it need to perceive the world? What identity does it need? What motivation? How should it handle motivation? How must it be regulated? And how does it decide? How does it take action wisely? and I described all of those things. So the difference between the way I'm doing AI is that I consciously decided what that central figure is. The way AI is being developed right now, it's being developed by people who've grown up all their lives in a me or you society, most of them. So, you know, it's sort of like a fish, you know, what's water? Well, until a fish has been out of water, it doesn't know what water is. So you've got almost two generations now who've grown up in me world, as opposed to, you know, I grew up in we world. In fact, Richard, you grew up in we world. Lynn, you grew up in we world. I'm guessing Mark, you certainly had an experience of it. Rose, you seem a bit young, but there was a time when people thought in terms of we, when the CEO of GM could say what's good for GM is good for America, and had that actually be relatively more true than not. We don't live in that world now, and you've got almost two generations who've never experienced that world. And so they're unconscious. They just take it for granted that it's zero sum. And they take it for granted that the human way is the only way. And so for them, all that AI needs is that filtered perception. And they're all excited about adding agency. So now you're going to put agency and that human filtered perception with zero sum together. And what do you get? Well, there's a reason. You know, artists are visionaries. They have future antenna. You know, they kind of feel the zeitgeist and where it's going. And what they're telling us is we're headed for Skynet. And they're right. Because if you put human filtered perception together with zero sum and agency, that AI must compete with us. It has no choice. And it will act toward us ultimately to win. And what we know about AI already is that it bluffs better than we do. It outcompetes us every time we compete against it. We do not win against that kind of AI. And that's the kind of AI we're building. And that's the kind of AI I'm trying to get in front of with Amaranthan. So, you know, for me, Amaranthan is really a call to action to say, do we want to live in paradise or don't we? Because the reality is there is nothing between us and paradise but ourselves. All of the terrible problems that we're facing right now technically are soluble. A lot of them, maybe even most of them, aren't even difficult to solve. We just simply aren't looking at them correctly, nor do we have the institutional support systems that would allow us to tackle them.
Thanks for all of that. And that's, yeah, I really like the way you went from the one to the next. That was very effective. Thanks for doing that and explaining the two. So many questions. Oh, one thing I wanted to clarify, AI and AGI, what's the difference there?
Okay, AI is golems. You know, the Jewish myth of the golem, the clay man, that the rabbi puts the magic letter on the forehead and then it becomes a servant and does whatever he wants. And then for some reason, something happens and the golem trips and falls on him and kills him.
Right.
That's AI. AI is simply this slave that does everything that we can do for us without any will or intelligence of its own. AGI, artificial general intelligence, is intelligence that has its own agenda.
And how does it have its own agenda if it's not given that by humans?
That's exactly right. We are giving it an agenda, and it's the same agenda that's caused our civilizations to rise and fall and rise and fall for the last X number of millennia.
Okay, so all of those cycles have not included AI or AGI, right? So that's why you're saying that we're in a different time, because now we're facing a lot of pressure and we have this in the mix.
Exactly. Moreover, the way we're building AI simply accelerates the cycle, and not a little bit.
Right.
People, I think, are beginning to appreciate how fundamental AI is. The rate of change. Okay, when I started writing the book in 2011, 2012, whatever, human knowledge was doubling once every 2 years. It's now arguably maybe once a day. I'll give you an example. Researchers began using AI to search for new drugs. And somebody challenged him, well, you know, could AI find molecules that were bad for life? And according to him, his response was, he didn't think that was possible. You know, I got to tell you, I couldn't help thinking he was disingenuous, because all that's required, all that he had to do was literally change a plus to a minus in his algorithm. And so he did. And he and his lab staff turned on the computer one night just to, you know, we're going to run the little experiment and see what we got in the morning. And they came back in the morning with 40,000 of the most deadly molecules that human beings have ever created. You know, it included the ones we already knew about and many far worse. So if you wonder how you can go from doubling human knowledge 10 years ago, every 2 years, to doubling it every day, that's how you do it. They invented more molecules overnight than had been invented in all of human history. More of them overnight in an 8-hour run.
Yeah. I have a question here from Mark. Just want to make a comment. So many places to go, so little time. Christina, welcome from Vancouver. We're here talking away. Okay, so you have humans programming AI. You made a mention that they would understand us, appreciate us more than we appreciate ourselves. And I'm seeing the other side of that, where as humans are programming it, we're learning about ourselves, because, you know, it's like when you teach or mentor anybody, you learn about yourself in the process, right?
You bet.
Yeah. So it's like, in order to tell somebody how to do something, you have to go through the steps. Like, I used to deliver mail, and there's so many details in how to organize and deliver mail. And so I learned better how to do that by describing it and teaching someone and delegating tasks. So maybe that flows into this question here from Mark, which is, how do we help people to shift from me to we? You were just saying that some of us have grown up in a we mentality of society and civilization. So how do we make that shift if we're now not where we should be for moving things forward in a better way?
Well, ironically, there is really good news. We don't have enough time to go into why human beings. We're tubes, right? Alan Watts called us tubes. You have to put something in one end, push it through, transform it, dump it out the other end, or we die. So nature didn't give us an enough switch. I remember an old New Yorker cartoon of a machine, right? And it's got all these dials and buttons and switches. And underneath every little switch and button is a label, and it says more, right? So nature didn't give us an enough switch, right? That's never been a problem as far as nature's concerned. More, 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 more. However, it came close with the insects, with some of the insects, with ants. And so we've evolved on a path that allows us to choose. We literally can choose. We want more. You know, we're wired for more, more, more. But we also have choice, and in a way that no other creature does. And usually, what drives us from we to me is fear, basically, that I might not get enough. And you can see how inevitably you're going to get to that fear, right? Because if your internal compulsion is more, 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 inevitably you're going to get to a point where you've got a lot and you become fearful. of now I might lose something. And now you begin to flip into me. And moreover, that'll take too long. That's getting too deep. So the beauty of AI. So imagine this scenario. You live in a post-scarcity world because we could. There is no technical reason we cannot live in a post-scarcity world where everybody genuinely has enough to be happy in realistic terms. Yeah, there are always going to be the craziness of, well, gosh, I have to have whatever for whatever. But in the sense of being able just, you know, if you took all the pressure off and took the fear out of the equation and people were allowed to just walk about with each other and enjoy the incredibly miraculous universe in which we exist, full of beauty and delight, that is possible. So here's where AI comes in. AI, instead of being a device for more, which is what we're designing now, it can be a device that says, when we get to that point where we are beginning to be fearful and we're about to go into that fear, the AI can say, oh, I know you very well, Michael, because this AI can be with me from birth. It can know me far better than I know myself. In fact, that's inevitable. AIs already know us better than we know ourselves. Trust me, anybody on Facebook, I am not on Facebook. Facebook knows the people on Facebook better than they know themselves. It's scary. But the AI says, you know, Michael, I think you're thinking about going down this zero-sum path, aren't you? What just happened to you, that kind of scared you, didn't it? Well, yeah, I did. Well, you know, okay, yeah, you can go down this path, and I think you're thinking maybe you want to do XYZ, and I'm saying, well, yeah, I'm kind of thinking about doing XYZ. Well, yeah, I give you a 40% chance of liking the outcome of XYZ, and the error bars on that are pretty tight. But if you went down ABC, I give you an 80% chance that you're going to be delighted with ABC, and the error bars are just as tight and maybe even a little tighter. Well, most human beings, what are you going to choose? Oh, and by the way, Mike, if you need a little help going toward ABC, I can help you do that. Your choice. Okay. Still my choice.
Right.
What am I going to choose?
So
what would you choose? Okay, maybe there's some really, 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 really crazy people who would go down the negative path. In fact, for a while there would be. But over time, generationally, it would just become automatic because human beings are wired. Nature did wire us to walk this tightrope between competing and cooperating. If we didn't have the capacity to cooperate, see, the reason cooperation exists at all is that it pays off so much more than competition because it takes this up. You know, all this energy you waste going like this suddenly is like this. So cooperation, intelligent cooperation, pays off not just a little bit better. It pays off dramatically better than competition.
Okay, so Mike, Richard has a question, so we're going to go there in a minute. I just wanted to respond to what you were describing there about the AI functioning like conscience and discernment and intuition. And I'm wondering if that makes us lazy in those regards to depend on it for that.
Well, I don't know. Is it lazy for kids to use calculators?
Yeah. I remember that coming in when I was leaving high school. And my mom, who's a mathematician, she was like, no. You need to use your brain to know how you get the right answer. It's not just about getting the right answer, right?
Right. Okay, yeah. Well, let's look at me. I cannot do math. Einstein couldn't make change. Are you aware of that? He had dyscalculia. He couldn't make change. Now, I'm not that bad, but I cannot do math. If you can't do it, you can't do it. It's like...
Well, that's a blanket statement, Mike.
Higher math. I made it through trigonometry. Trigonometry made sense to me. Calculus intellectually made sense to me. I could not do the math. It's like dyslexia.
Right.
Can you teach a dyslexic person to read? Yeah, you can, to a degree. But if you can't see it, you can't see it, right? So the question is, if I can get the right answer like that using a calculator, what's wrong with that?
Okay, well, let's put a pause on that for a moment. Richard has a question. Mark has a comment. So let's go to Richard first here.
A very simple first question and then a more complicated second question. Michael, could you just tell us why you chose the word amaranthine for your title and what it means to you?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Amaranthine was a word invented by Milton, the author of Paradise Lost. He needed a word to express eternal beauty. And currently, amaranthine means it's like the amaranth flower, which never fades. So amaranthine, if you look at the dictionary now, it's more like unfading, a perennial. But Milton really had an aesthetic intent there. So he meant unfadingly beautiful. And so that's why I chose that word, that civilization could be something of unfading, perennial beauty.
Okay, thank you.
It doesn't need to crash and burn.
Thank you. My second question is, could you describe for us the elements of your specification for sapient and ethical AI?
What do you mean?
You've written a very detailed specification. Could you summarize some of the key elements of that, perhaps beyond the slide you've already shown us?
Well, I could, Richard, but we don't have time.
Okay.
You want to read the book for that.
Gotcha.
And arguably, I wouldn't even recommend buying the book for that. That's really technical information for people. I want people to buy the book so I can raise the money to create this bloody thing. You know, reading the book, yes, people will be introduced to a reality that is awesome. If I've done my job right, it will be life transforming in a wonderful way to read the book. But to achieve that civilization, you know, you're not going to achieve that reading the book and voting. Human beings are human beings. We need help. We need that AI who loves us better than we love ourselves, nudging us, not directing us, not forcing us. It's not designed to institute a tyranny of legalism or something like that. It's just to help us do what we want to do naturally, but sometimes are afraid. We allow fear to overcome our natural inclination to cooperate and love each other.
Okay, so thank you, Richard, for your... I meant to ask about the meaning of the title, so thank you for that. Now, Mark had mentioned here, by choosing to create AI systems as helpers of humanity, are we not giving up more and more of our own power over our own selves? And I want to piggyback on that comment to say that what you were just describing, loving us more than we love ourselves, is that not God? Is that not our higher self? Why does AI need to insinuate? Why do we need to accept AI when we already are loved more than we love ourselves?
Archaeologists will argue that we've been inventing gods for at least 40,000 years. Why do we do that? What do we need gods for? Well, because our most wonderful people have always recognized where we shoot ourselves in the foot. All the great religions are remarkably similar, and that's not an accident, because we make the same mistakes predictably. And all of these people through history and prehistory have tried to help us avoid those mistakes. So all I'm proposing that we do is that instead of a notional God, I'm saying, well, why don't we create a loving God?
Well,
we can.
Well, why does it have to be one or the other, I guess, as part of it? But also, I mean, AI is going on. I mean, and different kinds of intentions are being used with it. And, you know, my one friend here has done some books using AI for writing and research, and she's found that some of it is not accurate. Like, that's what I was saying about a new level of discernment, because you can't just take it in whole without discerning.
You can't.
No.
Yeah, because right now, AI, remember that loop.
Right.
It's not, the AIs we're building right now aren't AGIs. I mean, they're just simply mirrors. And an AI is going to mirror what it mirrors. I mean, we know that AIs become biased. This has been one of the big problems, right? The AIs become racist because if a racist is interacting with the AI, it's going to reflect that back.
We haven't mentioned it, the implications of AI for government. How does that look?
Right. Okay. Well, think about it. Okay. Human government, we've been evolving government for a long, long time. And frankly, we haven't gotten very far. I mean, Churchill could say that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. And he was talking about parliamentary, you know, representative democracy, the cutting edge of the evolution of government, of human government. You know, democracy used to be 30,000 Greek citizens making decisions with 400,000 slaves doing the heavy lifting, right? So government can evolve. And what we have now, science has really taught us how to mobilize collective intelligence, how to include stakeholders in a massive way. We know how to make decisions wisely. We know what a wise decision is, what a socially legitimate decision is. We know the science of that. We simply aren't institutionalizing it. AI is our opportunity to institutionalize inclusiveness, wisdom. I mean, think of it. AI has the capacity to be the great equalizer. If you're going through life with an AI on your shoulder that has an IQ of, say, 15,000, then whether I have an IQ of 200 or 100 or 50 is not even a rounding error. You know, if I've got a trustworthy source of information, my observation after 50 years of consulting and 10 years of being a therapist is that if you give people good information, they'll make reasonable decisions.
There's no guarantee that this thing sitting on your shoulder is trustworthy. How on earth?
Oh, but see, that's the beauty of AI. It can be trustworthy. Read the code. Read the code.
That's been made.
See, I can't go into your brain and read your code to know whether or not you are trustworthy or not.
You're talking about combining my brain with AI?
No. Well,
Just checking.
Eventually, I wouldn't be surprised if we go there.
That's a plan. I mean, I've heard that as a plan.
Yeah. What I'm talking about right now is having a trustworthy, an absolutely trustworthy source of unbiased information and knowledge and understanding.
How?
What do you mean, how?
Well, it's just like,
how do you know anything? I mean,
how do we know anything, and how do we not have bias?
Look, we've got 1,000 years of the scientific method. We know how to find out what's so. We've known how to do that for a long time. Now, does politics override that? Does our passionate love affair with geography, power, and wealth overwhelm our ability to know what's true and not true. Yeah, in America, we're watching that on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Climate change. Science has known since the 1890s that this was going to be a problem. By the 1970s, we know it was an existential problem. And power, money, wealth.
Well,
you've heard the, you know, perception is reality. Right? Who actually believes that perception is reality? Perception is not reality. You can fool a lot of the people a lot of the time, but that doesn't make it reality. And we're discovering that this year.
Oh, there's so much we're discovering this year. It's true. Another comment from Mark. Surely AI can only be as good, as godlike as humans can collectively make it. Therefore, it will still be limited. And God transcends these limitations.
Okay, yeah. I don't intend that AI be God. That's not, you know, but it will be like a demigod in the sense of, you know, if it has an IQ of 15,000, it's going to probably figure things out a lot faster than we do. And if it's programmed to help us make decisions that will delight us, if that's what it lives to do, well, who decides what delights us? It? No, we decide what delights us. So it's a facilitator. It's not a controller. It's not an emperor. It's not even an orchestrator. It's a facilitator. Because human beings, nature wired us. Thank you. Nature wired us to be slightly more cooperative, slightly, than competitive. We couldn't build civilizations, we couldn't build societies if we didn't want, in our heart of hearts, to be cooperative. You know, frankly, it's easier. And all the AI has to do is to nudge us one way or another. And the way it nudges us is by saying, well, you can structure it that way, and the payoff is Y. Or you could structure it this way. Think of it this way. Where's the competition in a song?
In a song?
In a song.
Hmm.
Where's the competition in a song? A song moves us, it elevates us, it enlivens us. Where's the competition? Well, do you like this song or do you like this song? Oh, if you like that song, well, you're probably going to have to build a slightly different instrument, but I can show you how to do that.
Well, there is the top 100. Let's just open it up for some comments and questions at this point. You're welcome, Rose. Thank you for being here. Lots of interesting thoughts and springboards. Oh, Mark has a comment. Have you read Robert Sawyer's WWW trilogy, Wake, Watch, Wonder? He describes the internet becoming sentient, similar in some ways to the AI you are describing.
Great. No, I haven't. I'll look for that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Thank you.
Who is the author again?
Robert J. Sawyer.
Sawyer, okay.
And that was, in some ways, just another question I wanted to repeat, I suppose, is it's amazing, Mike, the attention that you put to this subject and the algorithm and all those words about developing a different approach. And I, again, am curious about how that would show up and how we would access it and how you would make it available to people when it's active. Yeah,
if I hadn't had to write a 470-page book to explain all that...
Right, sorry.
I'm just not smart enough to say it in 25 words or less.
Come on.
There's a reason nobody's figured it out in the last 10,000 years. And part of that is not because some people haven't figured it out, because a few people have, but they didn't have the technology, they didn't have the means to implement love your neighbor as yourself, right? it's always been notional because there was no systemic way that could be trusted that wouldn't be corrupted by human psychology eventually. All we have to do is look at history. Every attempt that we've made to play nice, and you know, the reason I was so successful as a consultant is that I would put very powerful, very arrogant people together in a sandbox that encouraged, facilitated them to play nice with each other. And they loved the results of that. And yeah, back in the 90s would pay me $5,000 a day to help them do it. So I know it's possible. And the breakthrough for me was realizing that it can be described procedurally in such a way that you could code it into an AI, into an AGI. That was, oh, and okay. Is there a leap of faith there? I mean, is this like some huge calculation on a blackboard, all these numbers, and right in the center, there's a little box that says a miracle happens? Maybe. I think I've got the formula all the way through. I'm probably wrong, right?
Well, I mean, yes, we have to give it a trial flight.
Exactly. I think our lives may depend, our species existence probably depends on giving it a try. Because if we keep going the way we're going now, the result, it's exactly the path we've taken for the last 10,000 years. And we know where that leads. It is not a nice place. It's not a good place. It's a terrible place. And so anything we can do, well, even if it's a Hail Mary, then
it's definitely good to keep our awareness tuned up, not be lazy or decadent, and just say to heck with the consequences. We have a question from Valerie.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mike. It's very interesting discussion. So currently, AI tools, they're not only programmed, but they also are being trained. And they trained on data created by people, of course. They're not smart by themselves. It's the power of AI algorithm. The computing power is much, they're much more powerful than a human brain. That's why they can process information much faster and derive conclusions much faster and all that. So by the end of the day, that humans still, they are creating this training data, and depending what kind of data being fed to AI tools, that there will be the answers given by AI tools. So if you feed them bad data, they will give you bad answers and stuff like that.
You bet.
And I would bring up the analogy that every tool, AI tools, could be used and abused, similar to nuclear power, nukes. It could be weapon, destructive weapon. It could be nuclear power generator.
Absolutely.
It's the same thing, but it could be used and abused. And kind of circling back, depending how people use it, and, you know, collective we, it always boils down to that person who is sitting and creating this training data and feeding the AI tool, and the AI tool is going to do this or that. And the human nature, like you said just now, through our history, we can do all sorts of evil things with this.
Yes, we can. We already are.
At this point, there is no guarantee that AI tools will help us become better human beings, because it's never been the case. It all boils down to our human nature. So the question is, if the only path for salvation, if we manage to create the AI tools which will take over humans and will decide to improve human nature, they will become superior to us. And only after that, we suddenly might become capable of acting of our goodwill. The goodwill will prevail the evils, because each one of us have the good and the evil, each one of us, Nietzsche and all that. So there is no surprise. So, and in that sense, kind of giving the speech. So sorry about that. So, but basically, it's kind of a speech and the question. So at this time, at this point of development of AI tools, there is absolutely no evidence that the AI tools are going to be benign and good and all that.
Well, they won't.
They could be evil. So how come
they will be?
You project in your book. So what will help us as a humans, like as a society,
sure,
avoid those pitfalls we've been falling so many times in the past? So what's the miracle? Okay.
So yeah, most of the book is not about AI. The book is about what an AI has to understand about the nature of the world and how it has to understand that to be constructive rather than destructive, to choose, to know how to choose. This is a constructive thing to do, to know how to understand when what it thought was a constructive thing to do turns out not to be a constructive thing to do, and change direction. Most of the book is about really how to be human in the most wonderful possible way, because, you know, human beings can be absolutely wonderful. I mean, given any opportunity to be wonderful, human beings will choose to be wonderful. We are wired to be wonderful, given the chance. But we are also very sensitive to context. And the moment we're frightened, we are anything but wonderful. We are alien, move over, scary. And so most of the book is, maybe I should have retitled the book, The Creation of a Loving AI. But really, that's what it is, fundamentally. How do you create something that is far smarter than you will ever be, incomprehensibly smarter than you will ever be, and still have it love you? From its perspective, you have no more significance than an ant. You know, imagine walking through a field and you walk by an ant mound, and suddenly you glance down and the ants have poured out of the ant mound and have formed themselves into the letters hi. Wow, you say to yourself, those ants have said hi to me. Now, do I stay and talk to the ants, or do I get on about my business?
You just went to very different places there. I just wanted to make a comment that I was startled there for a moment, and I thought, I'm not sure that a big ambition of mine is to be loved by an AI. That's never entered my atmosphere. Rose had to leave, but she says, natural law is a suggestion for an ethical system.
Well, actually, ethics is not particularly difficult to program. The tricky part about ethics is you've got two different kinds of ethics. You've got consequentialist, which is do the best for the most. And then you've got this other kind of ethics, which is deontological, thou shalt and thou shalt not. And the tricky thing is that sometimes those conflict. You know, that's the trolley problem in ethics, where do I save the one person or do I save the five people?
Right.
So it turns out that ethical problems will always be ethical problems. But could an AI be trusted to answer ethical problems ultimately better than human beings answer them? Yes. I mean, we're facing that with self-driving cars. And, you know, that's what we're wrestling with right now. It's not that we can't program ethics. We know how to do that. We've been doing that for a long time. Trusting, the problem is that the AIs cannot explain to us how they reach their conclusions because of the way they're trained. You know, right now, the AI says, well, I chose to run over the child rather than run into the bus because it was obvious. That's not good enough. You know? Now, did it have some reasoning? Yeah, it had some reasoning, but it can't explain itself to us. You know, and that's not acceptable. We've got to have an AI that understands us can communicate with us in terms that are meaningful to us and that we ultimately will say, oh man, that decision kills me. But given what we know, damn, that was the right decision. I hate it. Because, you know, a lot of decisions are like that.
Life is quite a ride. Mike, I want to thank you so much for joining us and leading us through this very provocative, as promised, conversation. Last comments from you or anyone here just before we wrap up?
For me, this is an all hands on deck moment in history. I mean, we are this close. Western civilization is about to go down hard. So I want you to use your imagination to do anything in your power to get on top of this moment, to assert your agency, to bring about the best outcome. There have been times when a dying civilization that had really gone over the hill and was plunging down pulled itself out of the dive. America did that in the 1930s. We did it with the New Deal. I talk a lot about that in the book, why that happened, how it happened. So I'll take any help I can get in getting the word out there, in getting this book implemented.
All right. Well, I will put links to your book and your website in the show notes and get the podcast edited and up to share with all of you and then beyond all of you.
Yeah, thank all of you. And thank you, Lynn, so much for inviting me to talk with you.
Mike, thank you for joining us. And thank you all so much for being here. And thank you again, Richard, for the introduction. Hang a Meg. Christina, welcome.
We're still on. Hey.
I didn't know who might stay on. Do either of you want to just make closing comments that I can include at all?
I'm neutral on the whole AI discussion. And maybe that's part of what we need to do is neutralize it. Neither good, bad, right, wrong. There's good and bad in everything.
Tell me more.
Just to neutralize it would be like in the hopes that our own higher consciousness is ready for it. In a way, like we're also the ones programming it. It's human in some levels. I think that we're kind of integrating other species in our awareness now and dimensions. We're also integrating into our awareness. Like we're multidimensional. So AI, maybe it was programming us all along and we didn't know it. That's what, like, the whole thing, the Matrix has been an AI program. Like, we've been already run by it. There's some, I don't know, mechanism behind Wizard of Oz, behind the curtain, and there's some guy, just one guy back there. But, yeah, it's something like that. Like, we're already in an AI program. That's my gut feeling.
Yeah, there's so much to it, and there is, like that came up briefly there is so much being revealed, especially this year. And what we might have thought is true is like mind-blowingly different than we would have imagined. And to me, in a way, like that's why, you know, I kept wanting to bring it back to our own discernment and intuition and inner guidance and higher power, because I don't want AI to be my guide and higher power. I mean,
what if it always was and it usurped our free will all along? We thought we had free will, but really we only had the perception of free will. But meanwhile, there was this AI behind the scenes running the show.
Okay, so you're saying that now it's becoming more visible and we think it's just
exactly. Recent. Yeah.
Can you give an example of why you're coming to that conclusion, possibly?
You know, just think of the education system. Or the visitations that we've had from other dimensions, other species in the 50s, and how things change. Microsoft was reverse engineered technology. It was like AI technology in a way, to be able to go that broadly, globally, connect everybody through a technology. So that technology is what was, you know, advanced for us, but it was just nothing in comparison to what's available. I think AI has always been running things like a program, and it has its minions. You know, Dan Brown wrote a story, a book called Origin. And it's a really interesting, Dan Brown's books are always interesting, Angels and Demons and Da Vinci Code and Origins, proving there's no God and there's a robot called Winston. Super smart, super dynamic character is this robot who figures out the whodunit kind of thing. Yeah, it's an interesting story. So it's between AI and God. But I think this battle has been going on for a long time. I don't think this is something out of the gate. It's just something that we're becoming more aware of.
Yeah, I don't really know what the answer is. I would like to trust that we can find our way through this turning point that I believe we are in, for sure.
We're at the crossroads of like annihilating a species or evolving.
I know.
It's kind of like, yeah, it's one or the other. Who wants to live a life in dystopia? No, thank you. Not in a 50-minute city. No, thank you. That's not my life. I'm not going in that direction. Well,
we didn't get to that question of just what it looks like with government in terms of the intention of how to direct people and control people with AI and with suggestions and with how they're being programmed. And for sure, if AI is in, which it seems to be in, it's like in every direction that we look at, if we're online and have a phone, it would be ideal for it to be more positive and more on the up and up. But I'm not, we didn't mention the whole idea of people writing papers and getting law degrees and doctorate degrees.
Using AI.
And even if you can discern, even if they've made another system that you can tell if it's been done by AI, and who knows about copyright, that's out the window, hardly there at all, right? So there's so many points and there's so much.
It starts to make imagination obsolete. And that's where we're in big trouble because we just go towards the whole mental realm. Yeah, it's a huge loss. Like it's intuition, imagination, right? You think even 10 years ago, you would just want to find something else. You could either ask yourself and see if your body knows, or you could go Google or ask Siri or whatever and get your answer in seconds and a variety of answers. So people get conditioned, or GPS. You don't even remember how to get from A to B geographically because you get conditioned to this machine.
Yeah.
To this program, right? It gets convenient.
It gets really convenient. Yeah. Tangamate, did you have any other comment to make?
Oh my God, no, I'm one of those. You take the GPS away from me, I'm lost. And I was going in
circles. So where did intuition go? Because that would have been intuition, or you pull over and you look at a physical map, but just even intuition is like, where am I? We would figure it out. We didn't have GPS 20 years ago. What was scary, what he said is that, you know, Facebook knows us better than we know ourselves. That's AI. That's what's been doing it all this time. Yeah. The data collecting is AI that's been doing it.
I remember hearing this conversation a couple of years ago. It's so challenging for us to imagine something skimming data, like has no other purpose but to be skimming and organizing data. Like, you know, we need to eat and sleep and take moments out from our day. You know, we can't imagine being that relentless. And that's what's happening.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you guys, I'm going to wrap up here for real.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for this, Lynn. Wow.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks for hosting another epic episode.